And you are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
The time now is 6 o'clock, and welcome to WORT's local news for Monday, March 31st, 2025. I'm your host, Sam Swartz.
And I'm your host, Kit Moore. In tonight's news,
prison advocates weigh in on the upcoming state budget.
Waupun Prison has been providing drinking water with unacceptable levels of contamination.
Plus, in the second half, we'll share the local government's calendar for the week ahead, explore big spending and political polarization in the state Supreme Court, and taste test some more shots.
All these and more on tonight's news. But first, we go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
First, today's news.
Hello, I'm Neil Nunes with the BBC News. The United States has said it expects all parties in Gaza to comply with international humanitarian law following the killing by Israel of 15 paramedics, civil defense workers, and a UN worker. But the State Department spokeswoman Tammy Bruce added that every single thing that happens in Gaza is happening because of Hamas. Our correspondent Tom Bateman raised the issue with her at a press conference.
I went on to press her about the issue of the State Department's own processes, because remember, the US is Israel's biggest supplier of arms. Under American law, US weapons can't be supplied to foreign militaries if they suspect they could be used for gross violations of human rights. And there are internally processes within the State Department that tend to look at incidents that they might be concerned about for that reason. And I pressed her, not for the first time, on an incident in Gaza, but she simply wouldn't go there, wouldn't answer that question.
The French far-right leader Marine Le Pen has condemned as a political decision her conviction for embezzlement, which means she won't be allowed to run in the presidential election in 2 years. She says she's innocent and will appeal.
There are millions of French people who are indignant, indignant to an unimaginable extent, when they see that in France, the country of human rights, judges have put in place practices which we thought were reserved for authoritarian regimes.
Ms. Le Pen has been sentenced to 4 years in prison, half of it suspended, for diverting European parliamentary allowances for her own party's use. A woman who accused Prince Andrew of sexually assaulting her when she was 17 says she's been involved in a serious accident and is in hospital. Virginia Giuffray said she had suffered kidney failure after a collision with a school bus. Here's Neda Taufik.
Virginia Giuffray is covered in bruises and in a hospital bed in a photo posted on her social media. She wrote that doctors had given her 4 days to live and were transferring her to a specialist. It's unclear where and when the collision with a school bus happened. Responding to the BBC, her spokesperson confirmed she was receiving medical care in the hospital and said Ms. Giuffray greatly appreciated the well wishes people were sending. Her sex abuse allegations against Prince Andrew led the royal to step down from public duties and to reach a private settlement with her. He has strongly denied her claims.
The United States has sought to defend itself over the pace of its deployment of earthquake emergency aid to Myanmar, following the Trump administration's announcement last week that it was dismantling USAID, America's main overseas aid agency. The State Department said a team was on its way and had set aside $2 million for aid organizations. World News from the BBC. The United States says it's deported another group of alleged gang members to El Salvador. It said the 17 men were from Venezuela and Central America. They've been sent to a notorious Salvadorian high-security prison where they're expected to be held for at least a year. Nicaragua has suspended authorization for the former president of Panama, Ricardo Martinelli, to enter the country, despite granting him asylum on humanitarian grounds. The announcement came as he was about to leave the Nicaraguan embassy and fly to the capital, Managua, on a private plane. President Rosario Murillo said Nicaragua wasn't willing to enter an international dispute. Mr. Martinelli was sentenced to prison for corruption a year ago and banned from running in the presidential election. A major incident's been declared in the English city of Birmingham over a continuing strike by rubbish collectors that's left 17,000 tons of waste on the streets. Workers walked out in early March in a row over pay and job losses. Residents have described mountains of rubbish. The two NASA astronauts who were stuck in space for more than 9 months say they felt humbled by the support they received. Nearly 2 weeks after they returned to Earth, Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore have spoken publicly for the first time. They were meant to stay on the International Space Station for just 8 days. Butch Wilmore said that it was important to learn from the process.
All the way up and down the chain, we all are responsible. So we're not going to look back and say this happened or that happened and that person or that issue or that entity is to blame. We're going to look forward and say, what are we going to use our lessons learned from this whole process and make sure that we are successful in the future.
Butch Wilmore, BBC World News.
This is Sam Swartz and Kit Moore with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Here are tonight's headlines.
Over the weekend, tech billionaire Elon Musk gave out $1 million checks to two randomly selected Wisconsin voters. It was part of his push to elect Brad Schimmel to the Wisconsin Supreme Court in tomorrow's election, reports the Associated Press. The Wisconsin Supreme Court declined yesterday to hear a legal challenge to the giveaway. In a filing against Musk's actions, Democratic State Attorney General Josh Kull said that he violated a state statute that prohibits offering anything of value to induce anyone to vote. Total spending in the record-breaking race is expected to top $100 million, including $4.3 million from Musk's America PAC. Musk's escapades and large spending have been a focus of the Democratic campaign as Election Day approaches, with rallies and ads focusing on his ties to the Trump administration and the large-scale cuts to the federal workforce over the last few months.
State officials announced last week that Wisconsin will lose more than $210 million in federal funding as part of a massive cut in funds dispersed by the United States Department of Health and Human Services, reports the Wisconsin Examiner. The funds were set to be used on mental health services, substance abuse services, and to support public health departments. Congress authorized the money during the COVID pandemic, later expanding it to cover all public health needs. Besides the large funding cut, the Department of Health and Human Services announced that it would cut approximately 10,000 employees from its workforce. It is unclear what effects those cuts will have on Medicaid and Medicare programs, which are administered by the department.
Governor Tony Evers vetoed a bill Friday that would have rolled back new testing standards introduced by the state's Department of Public Instruction last summer, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. The new testing standards lowered the threshold for what was considered proficient reading and math skills for third through eighth graders, and they've been met with backlash from Republicans in the state legislature. As part of their bill, state legislatures attempt to make it so that the Department of Public Instruction would need to seek their approval before updating testing standards. Evers had previously been critical of the DPI's rollout of the new testing benchmarks, but in his veto statement, he focused on the legislature's attempt to undermine the state's education leaders. The superintendent of the Department of Public Instruction is an elected position in the state of Wisconsin. In the election tomorrow, Liberal incumbent Jill Underly is running against conservative Brittany Kinzer to head the department.
Republicans in the Wisconsin legislature have introduced a new bill that would bar school districts from seeking permanent funding increases through referendums and instead limiting them to four-year requests, reports the Wisconsin Examiner. In recent years, school districts across the state have increasingly turned to spending referendums to maintain services, in part because districts do not automatically adjust their revenue for inflation. Legislators introduced the bill in reaction to a recent referendum in Milwaukee that voters approved, which increased the operating budget of the district by more than $250 million. Another part of the bill would limit the amount of state aid that a district could receive after passing a large spending referendum, which seems designed to be particularly punishing for large public school districts.
The Wisconsin Hospital Association released a report today that said that approximately 9% of hospital jobs in Wisconsin are vacant, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The job vacancies are concentrated in the nursing workforce, which makes up around half of hospital employees. The number of working nurses has increased in Wisconsin over the last few years, but has not matched the increase in demand stemming from an aging population. The hospital job vacancy rate spiked during the COVID pandemic, peaking at nearly 10% in September of 2022. The new numbers indicate a small reduction in the rate, but it has not fallen to pre-pandemic levels, which were between 5 and 6%.
The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee announced today that the former chancellor of UW-Stevens Point, Thomas Gibson, has been selected to be the new chancellor for the Panthers, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. UW-Milwaukee has faced dropping enrollment and several rounds of budget cuts over the last few years, including controversial closures at their branch campuses. Gibson said that balancing the budget is likely to be an ongoing challenge at the university.
The Madison Public Market announced today that it was delaying its opening, with a planned opening in the late fall, reports the Capital Times. The market had previously been slated to open this July, but it's faced construction delays after parts necessary to provide electricity to the site did not arrive on time. The delays are not expected to affect the budget for the project, which remains at $24 million. The market, which is situated on Madison's Near East Side, has faced numerous delays and setbacks in its more than a decade-long path to completion. The market is still determining the vendors that will be hosted in the building and is still accepting applications from interested vendors.
Tomorrow is April Fool's Day, but it's not a joke that it's also Election Day in the state of Wisconsin. Tomorrow's races include a Supreme Court seat, the head of the Department of Public Instruction, and seats on the Madison City Council. Polls will be open from 7 in the morning to 8 in the evening. Voters can see what will be on their ballot at myvote.wi.gov, as well as find out what type of identification will be required at their voting location. Voters who have not yet registered can do so at their polling location tomorrow and will be required to provide proof of address. Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Blatant corruption in U.S. politics is legal, even though the U.S. Supreme Court pretends it's not. That's according to a new analysis from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. As the latest example, the report cites Elon Musk's purchase of power in the Trump administration, as millions of campaign dollars have poured into the Wisconsin Supreme Court election. Judith Ruiz Branch of Wisconsin News Connection has the story.
Tomorrow's Wisconsin Supreme Court election is now the most expensive judicial race in American history. A new report says, ironically, one of the consequences of Supreme Court rulings is a model of reciprocity spending in elections. Since Elon Musk spent $250 million to elect President Donald Trump, he's been rewarded with unprecedented powers over the federal government. Now his sights are set on Wisconsin. Brandon Novick with the Center for Economic and Policy Research sees it as corruption and says it isn't new, and Novick contends it's legal thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court's Buckley versus Valeo ruling in 1976.
That decision was the root one that said money is speech and that people can infinitely spend in elections. In Citizens United, basically the court said, based on this, we're saying corporations, not just individuals, can infinitely spend in elections.
In an attempt to avoid the appearance of quid pro quo corruption, Novick says the nation's highest court clarified that unlimited spending to influence election outcomes is okay, so long as the cash is spent independently and not in coordination with the candidate's official campaign. But billionaires are not just buying power from Republicans. Novick points to Reid Hoffman, who spent some $17 million to get former Vice President Kamala Harris elected. He says when Hoffman called for Federal Trade Commission Chair Lina Khan to get the boot, Harris refused to commit to keeping Khan in her post.
This issue is bipartisan. The establishments of both parties are not working to solve it. But the current Trump administration is the greatest example of that blatant billionaire control bought through bribes and campaign spending.
Good government groups have long argued that in American democracy, one citizen, not $1, should equal one vote. Novick contends there are only two viable pathways to get money out of politics. The U.S. Supreme Court could overturn previous decisions, which is unlikely since many of today's justices were involved in Citizens United.
The only other way to get past this is a constitutional amendment to overturn their decision and get money out of politics. Because if Congress just passes a law, they'll strike it down.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
State lawmakers are poised to start crafting the state's next budget. Advocates are hoping lawmakers also keep in mind the needs of locked-up Wisconsinites as they craft policy. WORT reporter Shayna Clark has more.
David Liners is the director of Wisdom, a statewide network of faith-based organizations focused on racial and economic justice. He's gearing up to lobby lawmakers on incarceration policy as state budget season gets underway.
For Madison Action Day is the day we try to get several hundred people from all around the state to come to Madison to do a few things. One is it's to reaffirm our values as Wisdom, our values about justice and inclusion, but then also to talk about some of the issues that are coming up in the state budget.
Chief among those issues is the closure of the maximum security prison in Green Bay without opening a new one. Governor Evers proposed doing exactly that in his budget proposal in February. Built in 1898, it's the state's second oldest prison. It was originally built to house 749 people. It now regularly houses over 1,000. Both sides of the aisle have called to close Green Bay Correctional for years, citing overcrowding and inhumane conditions, along with the facility's age. The question is how, and whether another prison should be built to replace it. Evers' proposal to close it without building another hit another roadblock last week after the State Building Commission failed to recommend the proposal. Outside of direct prison reform, organizers of the Action Day have other policies they're focusing on.
We're going to talk about the need to treat immigrants more fairly and especially to allow for driver's licenses for people who are undocumented. We're going to talk about the need for adequate school funding so districts don't keep having to go to have referendums just to keep from losing more ground. And we're going to talk about the need for health care. First, that we need to call on our legislators to help us to defend Medicaid against any potential federal cuts. And then we have to finally accept the Badger Care expansion that we haven't accepted for the last 10 years, which has left 90,000 people uninsured and has cost us actually money to do that.
The Action Day is next week Thursday, April 10th. It starts at 8 a.m. at the Masonic Center. Lobbying will take place in the afternoon, and the event is open to community members. You can learn more about Madison Action Day and register for the event at wisdomwisconsin.org.
We need to show, we need to get our voices heard. We need the people who make decisions to understand that it's not just a few of us. There's a lot of us who really do feel like we can do better as a state, and we can be a state where everybody is included and everybody is taken care of.
Wisconsin's prison population is projected to reach over 24,000 by the end of the next two-year budget. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Shayna Clark.
It's now 6:17 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
Waupun Prison has grappled with indictments of officials for corruption and malfeasance at all levels, along with multiple inmate deaths and a prolonged lockdown. A new investigation from WORT's David Ahrens finds that the aging maximum security prison, which is now more than 170 years old, has been providing drinking water with unacceptable levels of contamination.
After multiple stories on the front page of the New York Times, Wisconsin's Waupun Correctional Institution may now be as notorious as San Quentin and Sing Sing. Its notoriety is not derived from the reputation of the convict population, but from the conditions of the confinement and the treatment of prisoners. In the last 2 years, six inmates died from a variety of causes. A seventh death at the maximum security prison, this time of a 23-year-old inmate, was reported this month. National news media covered the subsequent indictment of the warden and eight staff members, including the nursing staff, for misconduct and abuse of a prisoner. For over a year following the restrictions due to COVID, the prison was under a policy of, quote, modified movement, unquote. That was, for all practical purposes, a lockdown. No movement outside of their cells was permitted, including showers, for 23 hours a day. Those restrictions were eased after 10 months. During the lockdown, as we reported last summer, the heat in the cells was 10 to 15 degrees hotter than the outside air temperature. Temperatures frequently exceeded 100 degrees in prison cells. Now we know that for over a decade, officials neglected to respond to environmental reports that the drinking water in the prison had dangerous levels of lead, copper, and radium. The dangerously contaminated water also affected inmates of the Dodge Correctional Institution, also located in Waupun. For decades, water quality studies conducted by the Department of Natural Resources found that the water in these prisons had lead levels that were often three times and sometimes 10 times the allowable limit. At the same time, radium levels in the water regularly exceeded the maximum allowable contaminant levels. There's no safe level of lead in drinking water. Adult exposure to lead is associated with high blood pressure, mood disorders, tiredness and weakness, and other disorders. All of these problems intensify with higher levels of exposure, usually through a workplace or for long periods of time. Radium, naturally occurring, is usually found in rocks and soils, but it can leach into groundwater. The staff of the DNR cannot explain why the water in the prison has high levels of radium, but the water for the city of Waupun, which has the same source, has very low levels. Here's Adam Vosquill, an attorney with the Midwest Environmental Advocates.
So it's hard to imagine that there isn't some type of additional technology being used. In the consent decrees that I read, I didn't see any recognition that other entities had already taken measures, but it's just hard to believe that they aren't, based on the fact that one seems to be fine and another is not, even though they're pulling from the same place.
The Federal Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry reports that bone cancer is the most significant health risk associated with long-term exposure to radium in drinking water. It is absorbed into the bloodstream and deposited in bone tissue, where it can damage bone cells and increase cancer risk. For over 15 years, the DNR tested the water and reported unacceptably high levels of lead and radium in the water, despite the stated statutory purpose of the Department of Corrections as the provision of, quote, a safe and humane program of rehabilitation for offenders, unquote. It appears the Department of Corrections did little to tell prisoners or staff that the water that they were consuming could make them sick. It's noteworthy that the Department of Corrections' official term for its residents are not inmates or prisoners, but persons in our care. We contacted the DOC numerous times and asked why they had received so many years of reports of the contaminated water and why they neglected to take steps to protect the persons in their care. We did not receive a response to these questions. A decade ago, similar levels of lead were found at the Fox Lake Correctional Facility. The facility was put under a consent order from the State Department of Natural Resources to lower levels of lead and copper in its water, and the state spent $3 million to fix the problem. But despite a similar problem at Waupun, no action was taken. In 2020, after years of reports documenting excessive levels of radium, copper, and lead, the DNR sent a notice of violation to the DOC. They required that corrections take remedial action to remove the contaminants and provide safe drinking water. In 2021, corrections and the Department of Natural Resources entered into a consent decree. Corrections agreed to make the necessary changes. $7.4 million was appropriated to make the changes for Waupun, Dodge Correctional Institution, and the prison dairy farm. The project was supposed to be completed in the summer of 23, but in February, the DNR requested an extension until November of 24 and full compliance by the end of this year, 4 years after the notice of violation was filed against the department. Here's Adam Vosquill commenting on the requirements of the state administrative code and the slow response by two state departments.
The standards that are listed in Wisconsin's administrative code do say that community wells shall meet or shall not exceed MCL requirements. And so the hope would be that it would occur much quicker than 3 years or 2 years, or in this case, more like 5 years now, right? They've extended that timeline.
However, a review of the water quality test for the prison last November indicated radium levels that continue to exceed the allowed contaminant level. You can't taste or smell high levels of radium in water. It's up to the people who run the water system to tell the consumers that there's a problem, and then they can take steps to protect themselves. When the Department of Corrections found that the water had dangerous levels of radium, they, quote, posted notices, unquote, and they say that they distributed a 2-page brochure to prisoners and their staff.
The health risk was low, and so it was a notice, but not so much a resolution or an ability to provide safe drinking water. It was simply a notice as they were obligated to provide under administrative law, and then a notice that they were attempting to resolve the problem.
The Department of Corrections spokesperson said that, quote, Health services staff at each site were directed to address any health concerns brought to them and report back to the point of contact, unquote. However, the nursing staff that would have received these complaints are the same health services staff that were indicted for official negligence and misconduct and for not providing treatment to inmates who were fatally ill. James Morgan, a former inmate at Waupun during some of the years of the consent decree, tells WORT he had no recollection of receiving a brochure.
We were not, during my period of incarceration, we were not made aware of any dissent decrees or consent decrees with the DNR concerning contamination of the water. None whatsoever.
Even if they did receive a brochure, what could an inmate do? Buy bottled water at twice the price it costs at Woodman's?
Bottles of water are cost between $1.69 and up. That's just drinking water, and that's not everybody can afford to buy bottles of water. When you're making, 8 cents an hour, if you're on what's called unassigned status, there were signs posted in institutions for visitors and staff not to drink the water. However, those of us who were situated in those facilities had no choice. We had no choice but to drink that water. We had no choice but to bathe in that water.
The director of water quality at the DNR said that they were concerned about the water and that the bottled water should be available, but not how they could get the bottled water. Steve Elmore, the director of water quality at the DNR, said,
there's information that was put out on a regular basis for staff on the condition of the water and the precautions people should take. Consider having another water source. I know that that is problematic in a situation where you have prisoners confined there, that they may not have another option for water. And that's certainly been a topic of conversation we've had on multiple levels and over time period in the last few years to make sure that bottled water was available to the inmates there.
Oh, was it? And, do you know if it was made available?
I mean, it was for purchase, store that's available to them.
At the same time that 1,700 inmates were left with no choice but to drink the available water, the state has provided bottled water to residential areas where there are high levels of PFAS. The water resources in those areas, such as French Island near La Crosse, were not contaminated by any action of the state, nor is their water distribution run by the state, as it is at Waupun. Nonetheless, the state provided water to over 1,500 residences at a cost of close to $500,000 over the last year. The cost for the care of the inmates in the prison for 1 year is about $250 million. Yet spending an additional $500,000 to provide water to the persons in their care seemed to be out of the question. Now, 4 years after the Department of Corrections was required to make the repairs, they have been completed. Early tests indicate that the water is safe to drink. However, the 2,000 inmates and staff of the prisons are left to consider what will be the effects of their years of exposure to these potentially deadly contaminants. For WORT News, I'm David Ahrens.
You're listening to Handcrafted Local News right here on WORT. Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of our show. We'll share the local government's calendar for the week ahead. We'll explore big spending and political polarization in our very own Supreme Court. And we'll taste test some more shots.
But now we'll take a quick break and then we'll check in on some world headlines. Back in a flash.
The 2025 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to Madison Thursday, April 3rd through Thursday, April 10th. This year's festival boasts over 170 films of all shapes and sizes, including the best cinema has to offer from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. We've got comedies, dramas, experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. This year we'll be showing films at the Bartell Theater and the Barrymore Theater, as well as four venues on the UW-Madison campus. And we'll be spending the last 4 days of the festival at Flick's Brewhouse at the Easttown Mall. The Wisconsin Film Festival curates, promotes, and exhibits programs that showcase the art of cinema. A complete festival guide is available in the March issue of Isthmus and online, and tickets are available at wifilmfest.org. The 2025 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to a screen near you, Thursday, April 3rd through Thursday, April 10th. Helping keep local arts alive for almost 50 years, this is WORT Madison.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at 59s.com. Phone number 512-1000.
BBC News with Neil Nunes. The U.S. has said it expects all parties in Gaza to comply with international humanitarian law following the killing by Israeli forces of 15 paramedics, civil defense workers, and a UN worker. But a State Department spokeswoman added that every single thing that happens in Gaza is happening because of Hamas. The French far-right leader Marine Le Pen has condemned as a political decision her conviction for embezzlement. She said she had not abandoned hope of standing in presidential elections in 2027, even though the court banned her from running office for 5 years. The Trump administration has sought to defend itself over the pace of its deployment of earthquake emergency aid to Myanmar. The State Department said a team was on its way to help with recovery efforts. Virginia Giuffre, the woman who accused Prince Andrew of sexually assaulting her when she was just 17, says she's been in a serious car crash. Posting a picture of her badly bruised face, she said she has kidney failure. Nicaragua has suspended authorization of the former president of Panama, Ricardo Martinelli, to enter the country, despite granting him asylum on humanitarian grounds. Mr. Martinelli was sentenced to prison for corruption a year ago. A major incident has been declared in the English Midland city of Birmingham over a strike by rubbish collectors that's left tons of waste on the streets. Residents say they have had enough of seeing mountains of rubbish piling up. Scientists say they've developed a brain implant that can translate thoughts about speech into spoken words in real time. Researchers in California tested the experimental device on a woman who had been unable to speak for 18 years after a stroke. BBC News.
The time now is 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz, here with my co-host, Kit Moore. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
It's slim pickings for meetings this week in Dane County and the city of Madison. Not everyone got their agendas turned in last week, probably due to spring break. But also, there's a very important election tomorrow on, no joke, April 1st. Forward Lookout hosts Brenda Conkle and Rebecca Kimball have the rundown. Give them a listen, and then, if you haven't already, go vote.
Welcome to Forward Lookout for the week of March 31st, 2025. I'm Rebecca Kemble, and I'm here with Brenda Conkle. Hi, Brenda.
Good evening, Rebecca.
Let's start with Dane County this week. In the county, there's only 5 meetings, and don't forget to vote on Tuesday if you didn't vote early already. Because Tuesday is Election Day, there are no meetings for the county or city on Tuesday. But earlier today, the county at 5 p.m., the Health and Human Needs Committee Opioid Settlement Subcommittee met.
Yep, they have a recommendation to restore additional opioid settlement funds for the creation of a centralized harm reduction and prevention drop-in center.
That'll be awesome.
Yeah, that's one of their main recommendations, I believe. And then they'll be getting several updates, and they will be talking about a public meeting they're going to have on the 28th of April. And then they have a grant opportunity, and they are also going to be talking about what has been spent so far in 2025 and talking about opioid settlement funds for 2025.
And at 5:30, the Personnel and Finance Committee started meeting. They're probably still meeting now. They have a monster agenda.
They do have a really long agenda. They're moving forward with a couple of affordable housing projects. They have landfill improvements. They have some technical ordinance updates, some leases, some road improvements, some contracts for the medical examiner's office, some changes to some personnel positions. And then they are going forward with the public electric vehicle charging infrastructure. They're also going to be talking about enhancing the Medicaid-assisted treatment for the program for in the jail. And then they are looking at opioid abatement efforts. They also will be looking at consulting for the new Dane County Sustainability Campus and renewable gas plant. And also, they'll be talking about community engagement through conservation action and storytelling at the zoo. And then finally, restoration of Black Earth Creek. There's even more on the agenda, so if you're interested, you might want to take a look.
And you can find that at forwardlookout.com. No meetings Tuesday, but on Wednesday at 9 a.m., the Dane County Broadband Task Force will be meeting.
They'll be getting a presentation about the Madison Public Library digital access efforts, and then there are several reports to the committee.
No other meetings on Wednesday. Thursday, also only one county meeting, the library board's meeting at noon.
Yep, they'll be getting their expenditure report, and then they'll also be talking about library standards for 2025. 2026 library reimbursements, and they'll get their director's report as well.
Then on Friday, April 4th at 8:30 a.m., the Dane County Arts and Cultural Affairs Commission Executive Committee will meet.
Yep, they'll be talking about their Cycle 1 grant review. They'll be doing the final preparation for that, and then they'll be doing the final review of applications by scored rankings, and then they'll review their focus submissions. They'll talk about some Dane art branding that they're working on, and then they have a bunch of other reports as well as the executive director's report.
Great, and that's it for the county this week. In the city, today at 5 o'clock, the Equal Opportunities Commission Executive Committee met.
Yep, they're looking at inviting the city assessor to talk about housing property taxes and equity issues. They're also talking about inviting Matt Frater to come and talk about the Fair Housing Choice Report that they do. And then they are working on their EOC work plan. So they're looking at racial discrimination in the workplace as well as some community listening sessions. And then they are going to talk about some future topics for the Equal Opportunities Commission agenda and setting their agenda for April 10th.
And at 6 o'clock, the Humanitarian Awards Commission, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Humanitarian Awards Commission started meeting.
Yep, they'll be doing a debrief of the event this year. So they'll be doing that. And then they'll also be looking at their nomination and selection process.
Tuesday's election day, no meetings, but Wednesday, April 2nd at 1 p.m., the Homeless Services Consortium Board of Directors is maybe meeting, but there's no agenda there.
Yeah, I suspect people were on spring break last week, and a bunch of agendas will come rolling in on Monday.
Yeah, probably today or tomorrow. Yep. On Wednesday at 4:30, the City Board of Public Works is meeting virtually.
They have a few items that may be of interest. There's going to be some additional noise associated with the jail project, so they'll be doing some pouring of concrete. They also have the East Main and South Hancock Assessment District, as well as the Flom Road Resurfacing Assessment District. Those are public hearings. They'll also be talking about raising the rates for the sewer utility and stormwater utility. And they have a bunch of plans and specs for projects, a lot of citywide projects like sidewalk, curb and gutter, concrete pavement patching, and all that kind of stuff. And then they will also be looking at adding excavation permit fees. They used to have them, and now they're reestablishing them. They're also going to be getting their 2024 annual report for Public Works, and then they are awarding a bunch of contracts.
At 5 o'clock on Wednesday, the Vending Oversight Committee is meeting.
Yes, they will be approving the who gets to vend where on State Street at late night. And they'll also be looking at their mall concourse vending maps. So those are sort of setting where the carts can all set up. And then they will be talking about the merger of the Economic Development Committee and the Vending Oversight Committee and getting their street vending staff report.
And at 6:30 on Wednesday, the Greater Madison Metropolitan Planning Organization, otherwise known as the MPO Policy Board, will be meeting.
Yep. They have some scoring criteria they'll be looking at. They're going to be talking about enhancing the mobility for seniors and individuals with disabilities program. They're shifting some funding away from Newbridge and towards the Down Syndrome Association of Wisconsin. And then they'll be getting a presentation about regional active transportation plan. And they got a bunch of announcements and staff reports as well.
On Thursday, there's three meetings with no agendas. 5 o'clock, the Public Library Board. 5:30, the Community Development Block Grant Committee. And 5:30, Affirmative Action Commission.
Yeah, like I said, I think people were on vacation last week.
Spring break. All right. And then finally on Friday, April 4th at 4 p.m., the Board of Canvassers for the City of Madison and for the Madison Metropolitan School District will meet.
Right, and they'll be tallying any provisional ballots that came in where people might not have had appropriate IDs that they had to reconfirm. They'll also be looking at the clerk's office pre-reconciliation report, and then they will get their inspector's statement documentation from each of the polling locations, and then they will look at rejected absentees and counting absentees that were erroneously rejected, and then finally they'll certify the results. So that's like the final stamp of approval on what the exact tally of the votes was, and they'll be doing that for City of Madison Municipal Judge and Alders, as well as the Board of Education.
Possibly even a coin toss.
Yeah, there could be.
It'd be
surprising if they did two terms in a row, but you never know.
I know. Well, that's the week ahead in local government. Slim pickings, but if you want to dig into any of those agendas, you can go to forwardlookout.com. Thank you, Brenda, and thank you, Christina Leffring, for engineering and editing. You can find a roundup of local news articles each day on forwardlookout.com, and you could also, if you dare, ask me and Brenda a question and have us answer it on air. So for more information, check out the extended version on the WART website, which I don't think there will be one because this was so short today.
It was very short.
We'll be back next week with more updates on the city and Dane County. Keep watching.
And don't forget to vote.
Don't forget to vote.
It's now 6:42 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
Wisconsin voters will select the state's newest Supreme Court justice tomorrow. The race is high stakes, set to determine the ideological majority on the court for at least the next year. From record-breaking campaign contributions to the political polarization of the court to widespread disinformation, Washington Post political reporter Patrick Marley shared his take last week with WORT's Andy Moore.
Let's start with the money swirling around from around the country into this race. These are record-breaking sums, are they not?
Oh, they absolutely obliterate past records. I think we've got some $80 million that's been spent on this race so far. That, you know, 2 years ago, Wisconsin set a record for any judicial race in the country ever with a $56 million race, and that was eye-popping. That, you know, by many times beat the previous record, which had been set, I don't know, a decade or two before. And now we're far surpassing what we did in 2023.
I was wondering if you could give us another sum for context. And that $56 million did seem like an impossible amount of money for a race, a statewide race. And now you said $80 million.
Yeah, and we're not, you know, the final accounting is not done. It's going to be many millions of dollars more than that. I mean, we're now talking about Wisconsin Supreme Court races costing what governor's races or U.S. Senate races can cost, at least in their, you know, final stages. So it is, you know, these kind of massive national type elections How much that's sustained, we don't know. This is for the majority, just like it was in 2023, but it sort of sets a new standard. You're starting to see these increasingly politicized and very expensive races in other states as well.
This is a little bit off the road, Patrick, so I apologize, but you've been reporting and studying politics in the state for quite a while. What is it in the water in Wisconsin that makes us so jammed?
Yeah, I mean, we are right in the middle of a political storm all the time. I've been covering politics here for about 20 years, and it's been, you know, it's a political journalist's dream, right? Because it is always the center of the story. And the reason is simple. It's that we're a swing state. I mean, we've got a population that is very closely divided, and you look no further than Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson being the two senators from the state to show you just how closely divided the state is. The last three presidential races all decided by 1 point, and you can go back much further for very close presidential races as well.
Wisconsin's Supreme Court race is nonpartisan. It's almost laughable to say that now. It's become hyper-political, as we all know, position to seek and secure. But that didn't happen overnight. You and I both remember races where people were hands-off of issues and distanced themselves even from the two main political parties in their own ways. That wasn't that long ago. So this didn't happen overnight, this hyper-politicization of the high court. What were the ingredients, do you think, Patrick, that made that happen?
I mean, it's been a years-long development. I mean, I've covered these races since, I don't know, 2006, 2007, somewhere around there. And, you know, at that time, you were starting to see increased spending, more partisan ties, candidates showing up at political party events, but always like trying to do it with a little distance. And back in those years, it was, you know, seen as a big encroachment of partisan politics into judicial races and had a lot of academics alarmed. And, you know, if we went back and we looked at what they were doing today, it would seem quaint. I mean, now you have political parties outright endorsing candidates because of a campaign finance law change maybe 10 years ago. The parties can pump just millions and millions of dollars into these candidates' coffers, and they do. And, you know, you had Donald Trump last night gave a telephone rally for Brad Schimmel. Barack Obama the other day endorsed Susan Crawford. So you've got the political actors fully engaged here. It's in terms of campaigning, it's about as partisan as it can get.
That kind of partisanship can get down the road once someone assumes a seat, be deceiving because, you know, a case before the high court on abortion is not necessarily is abortion a right or not. It hardly ever is. There's those intricacies, but people are doing their best to think that they're getting what they're getting for their money, I suppose. But when it comes to issues like women's health care and other things, and as you've learned about the responsibilities of the Supreme Court justice in your years of coverage, I hate to turn a reporter into a UW professor, but what do you think voters should be thinking of when examining a high court candidate's record for this election?
Well, I think it's important to look at their records on the types of issues that will come to the court. So, and both have records. Brad Schimmel's a former attorney general. He served one term. He's been on the court. He's a longtime prosecutor. He's taken positions on, you know, legal positions as an attorney in those roles on things like Act 10, the union restrictions that were passed under Scott Walker, on voter ID, on abortion issues. Susan Crawford, who was an advisor and top aide to Jim Doyle when he was governor and served in private practice representing Planned Parenthood and some unions, and then a judge, she has a record on these types of issues as well. Those are the kinds of cases that come to the Supreme Court. You know, there are other issues that may light up certain voters, that get them concerned, but they're maybe less likely to come to the court. But, you know, what we know is coming to the court, it's going to decide some big abortion cases before either of these people will be seated. They're going to, you know, the election's April 1, but they don't get seated until August 1st. But the courts this summer are going to decide, or maybe even in the spring, decide a couple of abortion cases. And those will be binding, but also, you know, the new majority could change or do something, go in a different direction depending on its makeup, but it sort of will set the new standard for what abortion policies are in the state. Act 10, the union law, that seems certain to come to the court sometime after a new justice is seated. So, and, you know, we had the Supreme Court had to decide whether the 2020 election was legitimately held in the state. it did decide that it was, but certainly future disputes over elections, particularly close elections, will certainly come to the court.
Patrick, for our listeners who are vaguely familiar with the political makeup of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and to further emphasize the stakes, such as you were just describing them with regard to these big ticket cases, please put the current majority minority in context.
Sure. So for about 15 years, conservatives held a majority on the Supreme Court. In 2023, that changed when Janet Protasiewicz won an open seat on the court. That gave liberals a 4-3 majority, which they hold today. Ann Walsh Bradley, longtime court member, part of the liberal majority, is retiring. And so this is an open seat. That means whoever wins, you know, will be the difference maker in the majority. So if Susan Crawford wins, you will continue to see this 4-3 liberal majority. If Schimmel wins, you'll have a 4-3 conservative majority. If you want to go in the weeds a little bit, you tend to have one Supreme Court race every year. And so we know who's up in 26 and 27. If the liberals win on Tuesday and everybody stays on the court, they'll have a majority through 2028. So they're sort of locked in for a period of time. If Schimmel wins, the conservatives will have a 4-3 majority. And then in 1 year, Rebecca Bradley will be up. She's a conservative. And so liberals would have a chance to take it back. So the stakes are very high for both sides, but the liberals, should they win, will have a more permanent majority, and the conservatives would have to fight for it within a year or in a year.
If the liberal succeeds, if Crawford is the victor, what will the national headline be? And similarly with Brad Schimmel?
I mean, I think either way, this is going to be a sort of pulse check on the electorate. You know, Trump won all of the swing states not too many months ago. His administration has been aggressive in doing a lot of things, and this will be a chance to see in one swing state how voters are receiving that. You know, Trump and Elon Musk, one of Trump's top advisors, have been very involved in this race, so they're really closely tied here. The Democrats have made Musk sort of their public enemy and a rallying cry to get people out to vote against Trump's agenda. So I think the election will be viewed as a sign of what direction we're headed into and where the midterms might go. Mm-hmm. Now, it is by no means a guarantee that whatever happens on Tuesday is going to happen in November of 2026. Right. That's a political lifetime. But it does sort of tell you the general trajectory. There's a couple of special elections in Florida for congressional seats. Those are pretty Republican seats.
Mm-hmm.
Very Republican. And so those will also be a check, like how do Democrats overperform there? Do they overperform so well that they could win one of them? I think, you know, these races taken together will be sort of seen as a barometer of the mood of the country.
Here's a quote. "Disinformation is misinformation on steroids," unquote. That's from an editorial in your former paper, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, how is the storm of online disinformation complicating your job and others in the mainstream political press?
Disinformation definitely is on steroids now because of the vectors through which it can travel, you know, on social media, and it just seems to have many more opportunities to get in the bloodstream of the body politic. So I would actually say in this race for state Supreme Court, we've sort of seen normal types of misinformation and disinformation. Like, it's not like, I would not say I've seen an escalation from 2024, you know, but with the advent of AI, there's a lot of concerns about the kinds of things that can be coming in the future. It's going to get harder and harder. And it doesn't matter that it's harder for me. What matters is it's harder for readers and people in the public and, you know, just ordinary citizens who want to know what the actual facts are. We all have to become much better at scrutinizing the information we receive because, you know, it's not just when you're reading the newspaper or news site, it's what's on your Instagram feed or Blue Sky or X, wherever you are, it's hitting you from all directions. And you just got to be on constant vigilance to, like, hey, is that really true? This thing sounds alarming. It gives me this big emotional response. Is it real? It might be, and it might be fake.
Patrick Marley is a political reporter for The Washington Post, and he's got his work cut out for him.
Madison Mixology is back with another dessert-themed shot, The Grasshopper. Feature contributor Charlie Belosky and fellow bartender Riley Capel share their opinions on the shot and tell us how they make it.
Hey there, everybody, and welcome back to part 5 of our Madison Mixology Shot Special. I'm your host and favorite segmentist, Charlie Bielowski. Today, myself and fellow bartender Riley Capel go into detail about another shot for you to try. So to finish us off for the evening, we've chosen to get the Thin Mint Shot, which is based off of the Thin Mint Martini here at Splash.
It contains cream de mint, liqueur 43 chocolate, frangelico, and cream. That's it.
I know frangelico is that hazelnut stuff that we have, at least at, you know, our bar that we bartend at.
Mm-hmm.
Like, have you had that before?
I don't believe I've tried it.
That stuff is the hazelnut. And okay. Hazelnut is incredibly good as the shot. It almost tastes like hazelnut coffee creamer. Goes down super easy. You hardly taste any of the liquor.
I have a feeling, too, we talked about while we were ordering these shots, too. I think this will taste a lot like a grasshopper.
I agree.
It just is missing that ice cream component where it won't be as cold and thick.
The grasshopper is definitely a cocktail that we'll have to discuss in later dates. But as of right now, I guess the closest thing we'll have to that is definitely the shot. And I will admit, upon looking at the shot, it's hazy and cloudy like you'd expect, you know, a thin mint or grasshopper or some sort of like mint chocolate chip shot like that to be. You can see the foam on top is actually a different color from everything underneath.
Yeah, it's kind of a mint green color and then kind of a grayish undertone to it. And then like Charlie was saying, it's got that foam on top. I think this will be a pleasant shot to take. I mean, we've gone through pretty much the entire day worth of shots.
We've had breakfast, we've had lunch.
Shots, we had some lunch shots. So now we're finishing up our dinner with some dessert shots.
It's a shame that there is no like real dinner shots. I'd definitely try something that tastes like maybe like a, I don't know, like a roast turkey or something. Like, what do you think of that?
A steak and mashed potato shot.
A steak and mashed potato shot. Maybe that's something we'll need to come up with, huh?
Maybe. I think that could sell.
All right. Well, let's move on to dessert right away then. We're going to try these mint chocolate chip shots. Let's see how it goes down the hatch. Just like a thin mint cookie.
It tastes, yeah, just like a thin mint.
That is insanely good.
There's not a strong mint flavor to it. It is very, very similar to a grasshopper, but can't taste any of the alcohol in there. It's got that nice kind of chocolate chip taste almost to it.
Mm-hmm.
It tastes pretty much like mint chip ice cream.
I think a lot of that chocolatey kind of almost tone definitely will come from that frangelico that's in there.
Mm-hmm.
Frangelico, of course, being that hazelnut liqueur, which on its own is fantastic, but included in here really helps to bring everything together, I feel.
There's also the liqueur 43 chocolate in there. So I think that definitely helps give it that mint chip kind of flavor to it.
It's got that chip, most definitely. I think the chocolate in there with that hazelnut definitely kind of speaks volumes compared to everything else that's in there. The mint, though, very present, just like a thin mint like we discussed. It's very enjoyable, very pleasant.
I would agree.
One thing I noticed about the shot as well, it's nowhere near as creamy as I thought it would be. It went down a lot more like liquidy.
Yeah, that's true. I guess I did expect it to be a lot more thick in that kind of, you know, like a grasshopper.
It was,
I mean, that doesn't necessarily just slide down in your throat necessarily, but this, you know, because there's no ice cream in it, it was more liquefied and it was much more easier to drink.
I agree. It went down a lot quicker.
Especially as a shot.
Yeah. It's a lot more, I guess, smooth, I guess would be the word I'm looking for. Because you can definitely taste when something is creamy because it has that almost like kind of cream taste to it.
Mm-hmm.
This one lacks cream in its entirety. Because of that, it goes down almost like a liquor or water.
I thought it was thicker than water, but it wasn't as thick as a normal grasshopper.
It's an in-between. That's all we have for you in this episode of Madison Mixology. I'll be back next week for part 6. I'm Charlie Bielowski.
And that's all we have for our show. Thanks so much for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Your headline writer this evening was Nate Carlin. Shayna Clark and David Ahrens were your reporters. Special thanks to Judith Ruiz Branch of Wisconsin News Connection. Thanks also to our feature contributors, Brenda Conkle, Rebecca Kemble, Christina Leffring, Andy Moore, and Charlie Bielowski. Victor Calzoni engineered the show tonight. Faye Parks produced this newscast. And Shally Pittman is the news director here at WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz.
And I'm your host, Kit Moore. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is the most freeform show on your radio dial, The Access Hour. Good night.
You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Support for this program comes from Greater Madison Music City. Through proven strategies, success stories, and challenges, the Music City Circuit, presented by Greater Madison Music City, will highlight music tourism's role as a driver of urban transformation, offering valuable insights on how to shape our future as a music city while empowering our local musicians and music-related businesses. The Music City Circuit, coming soon to select streaming platforms. More information at ourgmmc.org.
Welcome to the Access Hour, where each week WORT offers you the opportunity to fly your program over the radio. The Access Hour is WORT's commitment to community access to the airwaves. For this hour, we have turned the airwaves over to a member of the public. The views expressed on the Access Hour do not represent the views of the station, its staff, programmers, or the board of directors. We'd like this show to be as unpredictable as possible, so we need your creative ideas. It's a fair trade. You give us what you've got, and we give you the facilities and any help you need to get your program airborne. So let your mind wander and wonder. And when the inspiration for some pretty good radio glows with a clear, bright light, get in touch. Just go to WORTFM.org and look on the left side for Sign Up to Host an Access Hour. Programs are scheduled first come, first served. And now it's time to begin another foray into the freest form program on the WORT schedule, the Access Hour.